Book of Esther, as I've told you before, it has been a surprise to me. I thought it was going to be this, you know, nicey-nicey little book, and there was going to be no problems in it, and, you know, what great faith of Esther and Mordecai, and they're just such amazing characters, and we should emulate them at all possible. And then we hit chapter one, and not too many problems there, but then we hit chapter two, and just everything is horrible. It's probably one of the most immoral chapters of the Bible that's out there. It ranks right up there with the book of Judges, right up there with the David and Bathsheba story. So it's Esther chapter 2. Don't just read this stuff and gloss over what's being said. Stop, take a moment, read it, understand it, try and figure out what the contemporary application would be to that, and that will help you understand this a whole lot better. So just a quick recap. Esther, there's a guy named Xerxes, didn't like his wife, so kicked her out. Her name was Vashti, booted her, had a beauty contest. Of all the women in the kingdom, Esther essentially became the queen, and she is now reigning. She is a Jewish person, and she has a cousin named Mordecai who has been kind of her guardian all up until now, and she has been hiding the fact that she is a Jewish person. How she's hiding it, we don't know. Does this mean she doesn't follow the dietary laws as prescribed in the Torah? That very well could be. Is she observing the Sabbath? Probably not, because that would be the clear telltale sign of someone being a Jewish person. They start worshiping on Saturday. That would really let everyone know who she was. So chances are she's not doing everything she should. She's in a relationship with someone she shouldn't be. She's not doing what her religion is asking her to do. And she isn't even where she's supposed to be. The Jewish people were supposed to have left by now to head back to Jerusalem to rebuild the temple. But all the Jewish people that didn't want to go were looked upon as pagans and heathens and just horrible religious people. And they decried them and denounced them. But Esther is part of that group. So again, when you think of Esther, I've been taught that as well all through my Sunday school, all through, I think even through seminary, talked about how, you know, important and how wonderful and what a great role model Esther and Mordecai are. And we find out that's really not the case. When you really study this closely, Esther is a, in our language, we would call them a backslidden Christian. They might be, she was more of a Jewish person by name, but she really wasn't doing everything. Now, I've been hammering her for about 2 weeks, and finally we get to the point where everything changes, and Esther has a change of heart. And this is what's the important message of the book of Esther, is that God uses flawed people, even in backslidden states, even doing things they should never be doing, and can use them in very mighty ways. Again, the book of Esther also explains the Feast of Purim, which is one of the two non-commanded Jewish feasts. Does anyone know the other non-commanded Jewish feast, but they do it every year? Around Christmas? Hanukkah. That's exactly right. Hanukkah is not commanded as one of the required feasts, and neither is Purim, but every year they do celebrate these things. I asked the person that's doing the Seder dinner for us, I asked him, I said, hey, Ted, next year we're thinking about doing a Feast of Purim. What do you think? Can you help us out? And he says, well, I've never actually led one, because you're supposed to get so drunk that you can't distinguish between the phrase Mordecai be praised and Haman be cursed, which are two of the main characters. And then the ban on cross-dressing is lifted for that day, and you're supposed to have beauty contests and hand out gifts. So I asked him if that would be acceptable, if he would like to host that with us. And the problem that he's always run into is it always lands in the season of Lent. And this past year, it landed on Good Friday. So, you know, while every other church is out there contemplating the cross and Jesus and death and all that stuff, we could be, never mind, we're moving on. Yes, thank you. Thank you. So that's what the book of Esther is all about. We've been introduced to three of the four major characters in the book of Esther. We've hit Esther, and she is also known by the name Hadassah. That's her Hebrew name, but she's going by the name Esther. Cousin Mordecai, who is helping out in this whole situation. And then the king, King Xerxes. The person we have not hit is a person by the name of Haman. And I encourage you, if you want to, one of the traditions when every year they hold a Feast of Purim and they read the book of Esther in its totality in the synagogues, every time they hit Haman's name, you can boo and hiss. And, you know, it's like audience participation. It's kind of cool. I would love to be there when the Jewish people actually do that, because, you know, I'm sure they're loud and rowdy at that point. So chapter 3 is where we finally get to this gentleman named Haman. come on. My goodness gracious. Yeah, I know. We'll get a running start. We'll get in there. We'll get in there. All right. And today, I'll just tell you right off the bat, we're going to try and hit two chapters, chapter 3 and chapter 4. This stuff goes by pretty fast. It's a story. It's a great story. Hopefully, again, you've read it. If not, go back and read it. It's a cute little story when you get past chapter 2 and all the bad stuff in there. But chapters 3 through 10, just funny stuff. Again, making it into a movie would be great. VeggieTales has already done it, so you can't do that. But just a regular dramatic film would be pretty cool. Yeah, Esther is a green onion. Isn't that right? Someone help me. Somebody always asks me that, and I'm like, I think Esther's a green onion. Is that right? Is it? Yeah, okay. Danny, our resident VeggieTale expert over here. So, yeah. And Mordecai is a grape. He's a grandpa grape. We call him Paw Grape. Yeah. So and King Xerxes is a big giant cucumber, big pickle. Isn't that cool? Yeah, there's no banana. Why haven't they used a banana? And Haman, was he a squash or a lunt? I thought he was a lunt. Yeah, it's not fruit tails. But there's a tomato. There's a tomato all through this thing. So, and he's, I don't know, it looks like a squash. It's a squash. I think a lunt is a squash, essentially. We would look at it in the grocery store. I think that's why his name is Mr. Lunt. Yeah, and Bob the tomato and Larry the cucumber. Yeah. So, yeah, it's good stuff. All right. Yeah, I digress. Excuse me. Here we go. We move on. So we've gotten the idea of what's happening here. Oh, and I'm sorry, just to get a running start, the end of chapter 2, if you look at starting verse 19, you probably have a heading there, Mordecai uncovers a conspiracy. And so he had uncovered a conspiracy to kill the king and warned Queen Esther, and Esther warned the king, and sure enough, the plot was foiled. The two guys were hung on the gallows. It wasn't a hanging like a hangman's noose. It was more impaling on a big stick. And these two guys were taken care of, and it was recorded in the annals of the king. And yet the strange thing, Mordecai does not get any reward for this whatsoever. And that, you know, most of us, when we do something good, we want a reward right away. Mordecai's reward doesn't come, and that's crucial and key to the story, because his reward will come later at a much more opportune time. All right, so here we go. After these events, King Xerxes honored Haman. Hey, there we go. Good. Yeah, Haman, son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, elevating him and giving him a seat of honor higher than all of that of the other nobles. Now, it's very interesting that we get this idea of the Agagite. Remember I told you that there's going to be a big contrast between these two characters, between Mordecai and Haman. There's going to be a big compare and contrast. We looked at Mordecai, and we find out that he was a Benjamite. He came from the line of King Saul, essentially. And it's interesting that Saul and another guy who was the king of Agag have a run-in. But these Agagites have been a thorn in the flesh for the Israelites as long as they had been pulled out of Egypt. They're also known as the Amalekites. And so these guys, the Amalekites and the Israelites, were just a feuding tribes constantly throughout history. I was trying to think of a contemporary example. It's not really that good, but it would be kind of like in the 80s when it was the big USSR versus US, yeah, on the political scene, but also especially on the Olympic scene. You know, why was it so neat when the Americans beat the Russians in hockey? I mean, if we would have beaten the Czechoslovakians, yeah, we might have had a party and that would have been cool and all, but because it was our cross-town rival, our cross-globe rival, that's what made the victory even that much more sweet. So that's, try and get the animosity there. The Amalekites and the Israelites just absolutely detest each other. Let's turn back, if you can, keep your finger here, turn back to Exodus 17. Exodus 17. I'll just point out a few of the events, a few of the times that these guys ran into each other. Exodus 17 is just a fabulous little story. We've covered it when we went through the book of Exodus, but I think it's just a neat little story. So we'll go over it real quickly. Exodus 17, starting verse 8. The Amalekites came and attacked the Israelites at Rephidim. Moses said to Joshua, choose some of the men and go out to fight the Amalekites. Tomorrow I'll stand on the top of the hill with the staff of God in my hands. So Joshua, remember, Joshua is kind of the head of the army, and Moses is kind of the leader, and then he's got his right-hand man, Aaron, and sister Miriam, but Aaron is essentially second in command, but Joshua is the general. He's in charge of the armies. So Joshua fought the Amalekites as Moses had ordered, and Moses, Aaron, and Hur, and we have no idea who this Hur character is, but it's great that he was there, went to the top of the hill. As long as Moses held up his hands, the Israelites were winning. But whenever he lowered his hands, the Amalekites were winning. When Moses' hands grew tired, they took a stone and put it under him, and he sat upon it. Aaron and Hur held up his hands, one on one side, one on the other, so the hands were made steady until sunset. So Joshua overcame the Amalekite army with the sword. Then the Lord said to Moses, write this on a scroll as something to be remembered to make sure that Joshua hears it, because he was down on the battlefield. He didn't know that he really won because Moses was praying and having intercession because of this. Because I will completely blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven. So God is making a promise that eventually these guys are going to fight. Now, this happened shortly after the mass exodus out of Egypt. The reason why they started off in such bad terms is because the Amalekites, after they were heading out from Egypt, remember, this is a crew of about 6 million Jewish people leaving Egypt. Kind of hard to keep track of 6 million Jewish people. There were sometimes people lagged behind. I'm sure when, you know, someone needed to use the restroom, go behind a rock, or little kids were going along, you couldn't travel as fast. What the Amalekites did was they picked off the weak ones. So they would lay in waiting, and they would never attack the head of the group, because that's where all the fighting men were at. They would wait until the last people would go through, and they'd pick them off from behind and then run away. By the time the word got up to the head of the army, there's no way they could turn around and go and attack. So that the Amalekites were, it was guerrilla warfare at its finest. That's how it starts off. Also, Deuteronomy, I have this up on PowerPoint. Deuteronomy 25:19, as they're getting ready to go into the promised land, when the Lord your God gives you rest from all the enemies around you in the land he is giving you to possess as an inheritance, you shall blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven. Do not forget. So they've been, this promise keeps coming up over and over and over again. And finally, one person has the opportunity to take care of business. And if you were watching Jeopardy last night, it was a Jeopardy question, too. It was who fought against the Amalekites and was supposed to completely wipe them out, but failed to do so. Saul, exactly. Very good. Saul was the king before David was, and God had given him a very specific command. It sounds brutal, but there was a reason. He said, you're going to attack the Amalekites, and I want you to kill them all. Every single one of them, wipe them out. Men, women, children, I want you to kill the animals. I don't want any Amalekite animals around. I want you to take care of everything. I want them completely wiped out. That was the promise that I had given to you, and now you will finally get this rest. And let's turn now, hold your place here, and turn to 1 Samuel. 1 Samuel, you're going to the left. 1st, 2nd Samuel, 1st, 2nd Kings, 1st and 2nd Chronicles, Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther. So that's somewhere around there. 1 Samuel 15. This was one of the big... Saul made a couple of boo-boos in his kingship, and this was one of the biggest. The other one was when he consulted a witch on the... Not the moon of Endor. I always think of that because I'm a Star Wars fan. But it was a place called Endor, and she was the witch of Endor. And he went and summoned Samuel, who was dead, and Samuel shows up. And you can have a field day with that one. Read that to your kids during Halloween. I mean, it's really spooky and crazy. So, but this was one of his big faux pas, 1 Samuel 15. Here we go. And you can see the heading. This is when Saul is officially rejected. Samuel said to Saul, I am the one the Lord sent to anoint you king over his people Israel. So listen now to the message from the Lord. This is what the Lord Almighty says. I will punish the Amalekites for what they did to Israel when they waylaid them as they came up from Egypt. That was the picking off of the backside. Now go, attack the Amalekites and totally destroy everything that belongs to them. Do not spare them. Put to death men and women, children and infants, cattle and sheep, camels and donkeys. Sounds brutal, but there was a reason for it. It needed to happen. So Saul summoned the men and mustered them at Telaim, 200,000 foot soldiers and 10,000 men from Judah. Saul went to the city of Amalek and set an ambush in the ravine. Then he said to the Kenites, go away, leave the Amalekites, so I do not destroy you along with them. Don't become, casualties of war. For you showed kindness to all the Israelites when they came up out of Egypt, so the Kenites moved away from the Amalekites. Then Saul attacked the Amalekites all the way from Havilah to Shur to the east of Egypt. He took Agag. There we go. This is the big connector right here, because remember, Haman's an Agagite. So this is where it's all coming from. He took Agag, king of the Amalekites, alive, and all his people he totally destroyed with the sword. But Saul and the army spared Agag and the best of the sheep and the cattle, the fat calves and the lambs, everything that was good. These they were unwilling to destroy completely, but everything that was despised and weak, they totally destroyed. So do you see, Saul was told, destroy everything, and Saul keeps the king and the animals alive. And I personally believe that we're going to have some lying coming up here. I think there was other people alive they didn't destroy. And I'll prove that to you in just a moment. Then the word of the Lord came to Samuel. I am grieved that I have made Saul king because he has turned away from me and not carried out my instructions. Do you think obedience is an important point with God? Yeah, it's kind of big. Samuel was troubled and he cried out to the Lord all night. Early in the morning, Samuel got up and went to meet Saul, but he was told Saul has gone to Carmel, where Clint Eastwood is at. And there he has set up a monument in his own honor and has turned and gone down to Gilgal. When Samuel reached him, Saul said, this is great. Saul thinks everything's fabuloso, right? Saul said, the Lord bless you. I've carried out all the Lord's instructions. He's all happy. He's like, hey, we just had this huge victory. We just did it. And Samuel said, but why then is there the bleating of sheep in my ears? This is where the King James Version really sounds cool, about the sheep of bleatings in mine ear. And what is this lowing of cattle that I hear? He says, letting him know, you know, what you've done is very bad. And okay. Thank you. Thank you very much, bad. Thank you. All right. Saul answered, the soldiers brought them from the Amalekites. Don't you love it? Who brought them? Hey, what am I fault? Soldiers. And he doesn't know the thing of leadership. Whoever's at the top, it's your fault. Regardless of what happens, it's your fault. The soldiers brought them from the Amalekites to spread the best of the sheep and the cattle sacrificed to the Lord your God. But we totally destroyed the rest. Didn't you like it? He said, oh, we did it for religious purposes. Yeah. We held on. Yeah, we're going to sacrifice them to God. Yeah. Stop, Samuel said to Saul. Let me tell you what the Lord said to me last night. Tell me, Saul replied. Samuel said, although you were once small in your own eyes, did you not become the head of the tribes of Israel? The Lord anointed you king over Israel, and he sent you on a mission saying, go and completely destroy those wicked people, the Amalekites, make war on them until you have wiped them out. Why did you not obey the Lord? Why did you pounce on the plunder and do evil in the eyes of the Lord? But I did obey the Lord. It's like my 4-year-old. But I did obey the Lord. I went on the mission the Lord assigned, and I completely destroyed the Amalekites and brought back Agag, their king. He didn't even know. The soldiers took sheep and cattle from the plunder, the best of what was devoted to God, in order to sacrifice them. But the Lord said, does the Lord delight in burnt offering? Blah, 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 blah. They banter back and forth. Saul's trying to constantly make excuses. And this is the reason why I think that Saul was lying and didn't kill everyone. Because Agag is there. They bring Agag in front. And they said, here's Agag, aren't you proud of me? I captured the king. And Samuel says, oh, great, thanks, good job. Pulls out a sword and hacks him. I'm glad I'm not a pastor back in those days, because, you know, some of the things you'd have to, you know, fulfill your job. I mean, it's kind of rough. If Agag was the only one left, why are there Agagites now in the book of Esther? Yeah. I think Saul, you know, wasn't completely honest. I don't think Saul killed everyone.
They were probably wearing skirts.
You think so? They were probably wearing skirts. They're all, yeah.
Yeah,
you know, yeah. There's a theory that it was the women that he spared, because then they could be taken on as wives. And in that case, then the Agagite line could keep going. So this is why, again, the tension for a good Jewish person as they're reading this stuff, the Agagites, this is big stuff. Okay, all right, enough of the history. I'm sorry, let's go back to the book of Esther. You never thought I'd get back there, but I am. So this is where Haman is from. Good, all right, good job. Darn this speaker. Ah. Okay. Verse 2. Oh, it kind of sounds almost Star Wars-ish. Isn't that cool? Yeah, like a TIE fighter going, or a lightsaber. Yeah, it's kind of cool. We're planning it that way. That's where we're actually trying to do it. That's the perfect sound that comes out. Verse 2. All the royal officials at the king's gate knelt down and paid honor to Haman, for the king had commanded this concerning him, but Mordecai would not kneel down or pay him honor. Then the royal officials at the king's gate asked Mordecai, why did you disobey the king's command? Day after day they spoke to him, but he refused to comply. Therefore they told Haman about... Good! All right! They told Haman about it to see whether Mordecai's behavior would be tolerated, for he told him that he was a Jew. Now, This is where, again, commentators get split, and I have to, I don't know why I didn't do this. I didn't put this on PowerPoint, so you're just going to have to furiously write. You'll have to check it out. You can either trust me, but don't. Never trust your pastor. He doesn't know what he's talking about. Go and look this stuff up on your own, and you'll find this out. You ready to take down some scripture passages? I can't believe I didn't put this on PowerPoint. Problem with me. Write down these things. 1 Samuel 24:8. 2 Samuel 14:4. Sorry. Are we there? 1 Samuel 24:8, 2 Samuel 14:4. 1 Kings 1:16. The rest of them are all in Genesis. Genesis 23:7. 33:3. 44:14. Sorry, I did not write, I didn't put these up on PowerPoint, because this is what everyone says. Isn't Mordecai just a great Jewish person? You know, here's Haman, and he's the evil, nasty, bad guy, and Mordecai, good, strong Jewish person, refuses to bow down and pay him honor. And because that's totally against his religion, and so he's standing up for his faith. That's not entirely true, unfortunately, because all those scripture passages I gave you were of good, strong faith Jewish people who bowed down before kings and rulers. Because the phraseology used here is not bow down to worship, it was bow down to just give honor to. Yeah. That would be the same thing if you encountered an Oriental tradition and you bowed to them. You're not bowing to worship them. You're bowing. That's a greeting. That's what you would do. That'd be the same thing in the military. When you encounter someone who is of higher status of you, you stand at attention and give a salute. You're not worshiping him. You're just giving the honor of the title that he's at. Now, Haman is second in command at this point. He's been elevated above everyone else. And so everyone is supposed to essentially come to attention and salute. But Mordecai doesn't. And it's not for religious reasons, I don't think. Now, you can if you want to whitewash Mordecai and make him as good of a person as you can. Yeah, say it was for religious reasons and everything's great. But you know that first passage I gave you? That first passage was David bowing to Saul after Saul was already supposed to be kicked out of town. And David has the opportunity to kill Saul and take his rightful place as king, and he refuses to do that, and so he goes to him and he bows down to the ground, giving him just honor as a king would be supposed to receive honor. So it's not a religious thing. This is not a worship the Lord your God only, you know, problem here. Now maybe he took it and used it for religious reasons, but I think I know the reason why. I think Mordecai's ticked. Because he was not elevated. He was the one that was supposed to get the promotion, and Haman got it instead. And now he's second in command, and he's an Agagite, and he good old Mordecai is a Benjamite. There's just ethnic animosity here right now. I think that's why Mordecai didn't bow down. Personal opinion, I think I'm standing on pretty solid ground because of all the scriptural evidence that points that this is not a religious issue. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. You know, Mordecai, he was supposed to have left to Jerusalem anyway. So, yeah, to all of a sudden elevate Mordecai as this some amazing Jewish faith person, it seems out of character. Because he obviously was very powerful in the king's court. He had foiled the plan already. He was high up in the religious system. He had taken on the name of a pagan god, Marduk. That's really odd. We don't even know what his Hebrew name was. That maybe no one knows who it was because he had totally abandoned that. Now all of a sudden to say, oh yeah, he's not bowing for religious reasons. No, I think he's doing because he's ethnically ticked off and he also didn't get the promotion. This heightens the tension. So here we go. And of course, all this, you know, all the people come to him and they're going to, you know, tattletale, essentially, saying, we're going to go tell Marduk, or we're going to go tell Haman. Yeah, good. All right. I like it. Verse 5. When Haman, nice, saw that Mordecai would not kneel down or pay him honor, he was enraged. Yet having learned who Mordecai's people were, he scorned the idea of killing only Mordecai. Instead, Haman, looked for a way to destroy all Mordecai's peoples, the Jews, throughout the whole kingdom of Xerxes. So this guy has personal opinion, I can't prove this, but I think Haman was short. I think he had a short man's complex. And he just gets totally ticked off when someone won't give him the honor that's due him. And so he says, I'm not going to get the satisfaction, because if he wanted to, all Haman had to do was walk down the street and order Mordecai executed, and he would have been killed on the spot. But he says, no, that's too good. I'm not going to just take care of him. I'm going to take care of all of his people. This is anti-Semitism at its highest, right here. And why is that? Because that's the ethnic problem between these two, the Amalekites and the Israelites. They are constantly fighting. And so now Mordecai, in the position of power, is going to say, I'm going to use this power, and we're going to take care of everyone. Haman, boost. Yeah, and little does he know, that there is an ace in God's sleeve. A lady by the name of Queen Esther. Because she's up there too. All right, so let me keep moving. In the 12th year of King Xerxes, in the first month, the month of Nisan, in the month of Toyota Corolla, they cast the Pur, that is the lot. This is where the Feast of Purim, the IM ending is just a plural. And most people, they've excavated this actual site, and they think it was essentially dice rolling is really what it was. So you had a six-sided cube, you got two sides, 12 months, makes sense. You could choose these things. So they decide to cast the lot in the presence of Haman, to select a day and a month. And the lot fell on the 12th month, the month of Adar. And then, I think this is kind of funny, because they're like, all right, when are we going to kill the Jews? Come on, baby needs a seven. 12. Well, it's the first month. They've got to wait 11 months to carry out this stuff. But they're like, no big whoop. We got 11 months to not only scare them and intimidate them, but eventually they'll be freaked out, and we'll have all our resources amassed, and we're ready to do it. Now, notice something. Did Haman ask the king yet? That's happening in the very next paragraph. That's how confident Haman is of how he was going to manipulate the king. So, then Haman said to King Xerxes, there is a certain people dispersed and scattered among the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom whose customs are different from those of all the other people and who do not obey. This is the classic half-truth, way to do it. Were the Jewish people separate and distinct and had their own customs and stuff? Yeah. Did they obey? Yeah, they did. There was only one that didn't. That was good old Mordecai. He was the only one. But it's great how he said, and also did you notice he didn't even say who they were? Didn't even say the name, the Jewish people. Is it just the people? And also the word one shows up. It doesn't show up in the English translation. And so the idea is, King, there's just one. That's it. One little tiny tribe of people that don't obey and are different from everyone else. So it's a minor deal. Let's see if we can take care of this. If it pleases the king, let a decree be issued to destroy them, and I will put 10,000 talents of silver into the royal treasury for the men who carry out this business. Now, again, in context, Xerxes has just gone off to war to fight the Grecians. And did he lose? Big time! And he lost all his moolah, too. And the royal treasury, the annual income, the budget of the year for the Persians was 15,000 talents of silver. And how much is Haman offering? 10,000 talents. Whoa! The equivalent about today would be about $6 million of Haman's own money. Now, of course, we find out that it's not going to be his own money. He's going to plunder the people and take all their money, and that's how he's going to deposit in the treasury. So he says, look, there's these people, they're a big problem, but you know what? No big deal. I'll take care of I'll even pay you to take care of this problem. And we'll carry it all out and we'll take it. So the king took off his signet ring from his finger and gave it to Haman, son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews. And he does something very interesting. Keep the money, the king said to Haman, and do with the people as you please. He doesn't even care. This is classic cool indifference. He's like, okay, yeah, take care of those people. Just get rid of them for me. No, and don't worry about the moolah. And he said, take off the ring. Now, again, the ring, you know, for us today, the significance would be if the president gives an order that the vice president can carry out any executive order, and it would be as if the president was making that order. That's what the signet. Whoever had the signet ring had all the power. So that person could make any law. If you have the signet ring, then seal it in clay, and it would be as if the king says it. So these two are tight. That's the idea. You were trying to get the idea that Xerxes and Haman are really close buddies. All right. Then, on the 13th day of the first month, the royal secretaries were summoned. They wrote down in the script of each province and in the language of each people all Haman's orders to the king's satraps, the governors of the various provinces, and the nobles of the various peoples. These were written in the name of King Xerxes himself and sealed with his own ring. Dispatches were sent to couriers to all the king's provinces with the order to destroy, kill, and annihilate all the Jews, young and old, women and little children, on a single day, the 13th day of the 12th month, the month of Adar, and to plunder their goods. A copy of the text of the edict was to be issued as law in every province and made known to the people of every nationality so they'd be ready for that. There were about 127 nationalities represented at that time point. There's a lot of languages. Spurred on by the king's command, these couriers went out and the edict was issued in the citadel of Susa. The king and Haman sat down to drink. Isn't that great? He just issued the slaughter of, you know, millions of people and he sits down. Yeah, let's have a drink. But the city of Susa was bewildered. Yeah, that's an understatement. Now, you might have missed that. This happened on which day? The 13th day of which month? First month, the month of Nisan. Maybe that doesn't mean much to you. I had to be reminded of it myself. But on the 14th day of the month, in the month of Nisan, was a very important day. We would call that day Passover. Let's see if I can put it in more cultural context. That would be as if someone gives an order to kill all the Christians on Christmas Eve. You get the, that's what's going on here. So these people have just received a decree. They're getting ready. The lambs are all prepared. They're getting ready to have their feasts and their Passovers to celebrate how God has protected them and brought them out of Egypt and watched over them. And all of a sudden, the night before they're supposed to start doing this, they get the decree, you're going to die. About 11 months. Man, that's heavy. That's heavy stuff. All right, we keep going. Oh, when Mordecai learned of all that had been done, he tore his clothes, put on sackcloth and ashes, and went into the city wailing loudly and bitterly. But he went only as far as the king's gate because no one clothed in sackcloth was allowed to enter it. In every province to which the edict and order of the king came, there was great mourning among the Jews with fasting, weeping, and wailing. Many lay in sackcloth and ashes. Okay, so at least we can say they understand what's going on here and are doing something about it, and they're weeping about it. And it's funny because Mordecai doesn't just go into his own room and wails and weeps loudly. Where does he go? He goes to the palace. Why would he go to the palace? Exactly. People have always speculated, you know, oh, Mordecai, the great Jew that he is, he's going to weep and fast and mourn and wail. I think it's interesting where he does it at. I think he's doing it for a very big reason. I could just see him outside of Esther's windows. You know, and hoping that Esther's going to go, what in the world is that? And peek out the window and there's Mordecai and his clothes are all gone and he's in sackcloth and ashes and he's crying and weeping. And that's what I think is happening here. So he's going to try and get Esther's, you know, but he can't go into the king's gate because, you know, no one likes people that are crying. They're depressing. They are. I'm sorry. Have you ever experienced that? You know, family member dies and you're really sad and no one wants to come around you anymore. It's depressing. It's depressing. That, and that's what's happening. They're not allowed in. Hope that doesn't happen with churches. Oh, yeah. There was a dress code. Yeah. Shirt and tie. Verse 4. So when Esther's maids and eunuchs came and told her about Mordecai, she was in great distress. You have to ask why, and the obvious answer is not there. Why is she upset? Simply because Mordecai is upset. I can prove this in just a moment. She sent clothes for him to put on instead of his sackcloth, but he would not accept them. Why is she sending him clothes? So he can come in. Exactly. Now, again, when you take some time, you're going to pick up the full story on this. Yeah. She's like, my goodness, Mordecai's freaking out there. What's going on? Hey, Mordecai, come in. I can't. I don't. I can't. Here, get him some clothes. Get him in here. No, I don't want your clothes. So all this stuff is going to have to be done by a courier. Just a question. Does Esther know about the edict?
No.
That's important. She doesn't even know yet. How do I know this? The next verses. Then Esther summoned Hathach, one of the king's eunuchs assigned to attend her, and ordered him to find out what was troubling Mordecai and why. She has no clue what's going on. She hasn't even heard about the edict. She's been just having fun with her little eunuchs and friends, and I'm just the queen, and we're having parties and teas and eating crumpets. She has no clue what's going on. No clue. She had to find out why, what was going on. We also find out, I'll tell you now because this heightens it a little bit. We also find out, we don't know, either something happened between Xerxes and Esther, or Xerxes is just not really excited about Esther anymore. We find out she hasn't been in to see the king in 30 days. That's going to get kind of odd, you know. If all of a sudden we find out, yeah, Laura Bush hasn't, you know, seen her husband in 30 days. Don't you think that's kind of odd? You know, don't they, you know, kind of live together? Yeah, this is what's happening here. She hasn't been in to see the king for 30 days. Okay, I keep going. I'm sorry. Oh, and I forgot to tell you, too. When this edict was issued to kill all the Jews, was this an irrevocable edict? Yep. Yep. That's it. You're stuck. The Jews are going to die. The issue was ordered, kill them. And there's nothing anyone can do about it. Well, except for God, because he's really cool that way. So Hathach went out to Mordecai in the open square of the city in front of the king's gate. Mordecai told him everything that had happened to him, including the exact amount of money Haman had promised to pay into the royal treasury for the destruction of the Jews. He also gave him a copy of the text of the edict for their annihilation, which had been published in Susa, to show to Esther and explain it to her, and he told him to urge her to go into the king's presence to beg for mercy and plead with him for her people. Oh! Oops! What just happened here? Did you catch it? She's hiding. She's been very clandestine about her faith, and the eunuch is there, Hathach, and there's no lisp in there. Hathach goes and Mordecai says, "You've got to help us. You've got to help your people." And Hathach's probably like, "What people?" Huh? And he started. I bet you Hathach's figured it out. The cat's out of the bag. Now, why do I bring this up? I think this is going to inform a later verse coming up here. It'll help us understand. So the cat's out of the bag. Now one person knows, and you know how secrets go. Yeah. Soon everyone's going to know. It'll be a matter of, you know, minutes for these people. They're going to get on their little Palm Pilots and their Blackberries and email each other. Verse 9, Hathach went back and reported to Esther what Mordecai had said. Then she instructed him to say to Mordecai, "All the king's officials and the people of the royal provinces know that for any man or woman who approaches the king in the inner court without being summoned, the king has but one law, that he be put to death. The only exception to this is for the king to extend the gold scepter to him and spare his life. But 30 days have passed since I was called in to go to the king." So do you get the idea? He says, "Go to the king! Beg for mercy!" She says, "What are you talking about? If I go to the king and he hasn't invited me and he hasn't talked to me for 30 days, if I just show up and open the door and say, excuse me, king, I'm dead. They'll kill me on the spot." I mean, there is only one proviso. That's if he extends his gold scepter out to me. And they've actually unearthed this. They've actually found out that this law was written. It's also written in secular history. Herodotus is our big guy for that. He says, yep, that's right. Anyone that shows up, except for the seven powerful people, there were seven people, the royal advisors, that could show up to the king anytime. Well, almost any time. There's only one time that he couldn't bother him, and that was when he was in his royal sleeping chambers. Yeah. And so that was the only time that he couldn't be bothered by the seven people. But if you just showed up and like, "Hey, excuse me," you know, like if you wanted to go see the president, you know, like knocking, you know, and you get past security, you're like, "Hello," you know, all of a sudden everyone's going to jump on you, and they might not kill you. They'll just put you in a holding cell and, you know, deny you your rights. Like in 24, right? I'm sorry. I digress. I love that show. It's a great show. So that's the thing. She says, "How am I going to go beg for mercy? I'm going to die. Do you get it? I'm going to show up in there, and I'm uninvited. The king don't like me no more. I'm going to be a dead woman." When Esther's words were reported to Mordecai, he sent back this answer: "Do not think
that because you are in the king's house, you alone of all the Jews will escape. This is the turning of the screw. I mean, it is an interesting thing. Look, either go in and beg for mercy, and you may die. Or do nothing, and you will die. This verse 14 is the problematic verse. You ready? People debated this all over the years. Because everyone wants to make Mordecai this cool guy. And he says this weird statement. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place, but you and your father's family will perish. That's the problem. Because right there, everyone says, oh, there we go. There's our God talk for the Bible. There's our God talk for the book of Esther. If you don't do this, I have faith that someone else will come and save the day. Well, there's a problem with that. Because if you take that as that statement, the next statement ain't that good. But you and your father's family will perish? The only way you can take that is, that's a threat.
Yeah.
Mordecai says, look, you don't do this? That's fine. We'll figure a way out. But you're dead. Because if hope and deliverance come and the Jews are saved, why wouldn't she be saved? Do you see the problem that comes up here? I think there's another way to take this, and I read this, and it opened it up. I think it's perfect. Take it as a question, as a despairing, hopeless question, and you can do that with the Hebrew grammar. Look at the way, look. If you don't do this, who's going to? We're all going to die. That's what Mordecai's saying. He's not saying, look, if you don't take care of it, I'm confident God will somehow figure it out. Nope, he's saying, we're lost. And if you don't do it, who is? Relief and where's the relief and deliverance going to come from? Your father's family is going to die, and so are you. That makes perfect sense now. So that's how I take it. I wrote it in there. Just this could be a question. And that's also the reason why, because it's not just a threat that he's going to expose her. I read commentary that said, oh yeah, he was just threatening that, look, if you don't speak up, I'm just going to tell everyone that you're a Jew. Well, didn't he already tell everyone that she's a Jew? You know, already the cat's out of the bag. Yes. This is her cousin Mordecai. Yeah.
So he would make sure that whatever.
Yeah, you know, because he's also in the palace too. He could be saying, look, you know, you think you're safe and secure. Guess what? Yeah, he knows people. He's a mafia hitman. No, he's not. Mordecai's not. So this is important because right here is where everyone says this is where the God stuff happens, and I don't think it's happening yet. Again, there's a reason why God's name is never mentioned. There's no religious activities in here except for coming up. We're going to get one religious activity and that's it. And that's because God is hiding. He's behind the scenes. Is he there? Yeah, because there's no other. You and I couldn't have planned this story out. Only God could. We have an irrevocable decree to slaughter God's covenant people. Would you say this is satanic? Oh yeah. Oh yeah. He's about ready. This is a stroke of genius. He's about ready to take care of business in one fell swoop. And it's irrevocable. Nothing can be done. Well, except for God, because, you know, he's kind of cool that way. The last part of this verse. This last part is where Mordecai does get, I think, his little redemption. I think this is where Mordecai says, and who knows, but that you have come to royal position for such a time as this. This would be the theme verse of Esther, right here. This is the theme of the book of Esther, that all those little tiny coincidences that happened in your life, just the fact that you're sitting here this morning, it's not accident. It's not coincidence. Everything happens for a very important reason. And it's all part of God's plan. He is going to use even an irrevocable decree of a pagan king to fulfill his will. Oh, it's just incredible. And also, a quick thing on this. Who knows? Some people have said, oh, man, but I hear the doubt. And, well, who knows? Maybe God will help. You know, who knows? Maybe you've come. Well, no, this is actually a word of hope because it only shows up one other time, and that's in the book of Jonah. Jonah chapter 3. This is the king of Nineveh. This is a positive. Who knows? God may yet relent with compassion, turn from his fierce anger so that we will not perish. So to them, if you use that phrase, who knows, to us it kind of sounds doubting. To them, that was almost a statement of faith. This is a positive thing. Who knows? But maybe you've been elevated to be queen at this particular time for a very important reason. Here you go. The turning of Esther, right here, this last paragraph is it. Then Esther sent this reply to Mordecai. Go, gather together all the Jews who are in Susa, and fast for me. Do not eat or drink for, you kind of find it funny, 3 days and three nights. Man, isn't that interesting? What a coincidence. Yeah, 3 days and three nights. I and my maids will fast as you do. When this is done, I will go to the king, even though it is against the law, and if I perish, I perish. Here's your big moment to shine. Now, don't take this lightly again. This is a death thing. She could die. She's going to go in and see the king, and so in 3 days she could be dead. And beyond that, maybe she's not going to be able to convince the king. And what is she going to be able to do anyway? The law is irrevocable. Everything's against her. What about that? Then she's going to have to let everyone know. She's going to ask the Jews to fast for me. Why would the Jews fast for a pagan queen? Oh, they'll have to find out. She's actually Jewish. She's now going to have to expose herself to the whole world, saying, no one knows. Yeah, even the king don't know. Yeah, no one knows that she's a Jewish person. Only Mordecai is the only one that knows. And so now she's going to have to admit to the whole world, I'm a backslidden Christian. I'm a backslidden Jewish person. I'm a backslidden covenant member of the God's kingdom. This is big. And to try and take that for what it is, she is going to step up to the plate. And she is going to make the decision, I'll go and see him. But you can still see, what's it going to do? Nothing. Nothing can happen from this. She's going to die, or she'll hopefully get some grace from the king, but he may not believe her. He may not care. I mean, he didn't care about killing all the Jews in the first place. Why would he care about his wife who he doesn't really even see for over 30 days? And beyond that, the law is irrevocable. Nothing can be done about it. We are at this is the greatest point of tension right here. And aren't you glad we're done? If you want to, go ahead and read the rest of the story. I mean, this has got to be one of the funniest. From here on out, some of the funniest things happen in all of Scripture. These ironic things and these twists and turns. Again, one of the themes of the book of Esther is the reversal of fortune. Mordecai was supposed to be promoted. And who got promoted? Haman. Reversal. That's a reversal of fortune. But it's going to happen again and again and again. All these things, reversal of fortune. Esther is this lowly, unknown Jewish person, all of a sudden becomes queen of an entire empire. That's big. Yes, Jeff?
If the king is all powerful, can he not reverse his own order?
That's the thing. Yeah, with this, it's the laws of the Medes and the Persians, which is, it's one of those, you know, again, in our culture, we don't understand it. You know, like, you know, the president issues an order. Well, that's okay, you know. We'll just unorder it. Or, you know, even the Catholic Church, the Pope is supposed to give an order that is the Word of God. It is infallible. And then you could have a later Pope come up and just contradict that. No, in this one, when the king is essentially powerless. Once he gives the order, that's it. It's now done. It is irrevocable. You cannot change. That's the reason why when it happened to Daniel, he was thrown in the lion's den. And it was an irrevocable thing. Darius liked Daniel. And he freaked out that whole night. He couldn't even sleep. And he ran to the lion's den in the morning. And he's like, Daniel, you okay in there? And Daniel yells, oh, yeah, I just ordered some pizza. Oh, no, that's the VeggieTales version. Sorry, that's the VeggieTales version. They ordered pizza. But that's the thing, because Darius knew, I couldn't. I gave this law, and now it's irrevocable. Yes. Written in stone, yeah. And there's also something important about this. And I didn't pick up on this the hundreds of times I read the book of Esther, but you and I are under the same curse. There is an irrevocable death sentence on you and I. Mm-hmm. You're dead. You will die. I guarantee you, I'll put money in Vegas. You're going to die. It's irrevocable. You cannot get past it. And you might say to yourself, that's it. We're done. We're done for. Except for, if there happens to be someone who could go to the king and beg for mercy and maybe issue a decree that would help. Are you getting it? You getting the book of Esther? That's the beauty of it. Let's pray. Father, again, as we read Esther, we know your name doesn't show up, and you use some of the weirdest people, and we're thankful that you use them, because that means you can use us as well. And I know, Lord, that sometimes it gets exposed to us. We're not where we're supposed to be. We're not doing the things we're supposed to be doing. And sometimes it comes a point when we're just going to have to admit it to everyone. We're not doing right. This is not good, what we're doing. All in hopes that you can still use us and have a powerful difference. Lord, we also know that we are under a curse. Just as the Jewish people had an irrevocable curse placed upon them, they're going to die. And yet, we wait with anticipation to see what's going to happen from this. We thank you that you use Mordecai and Esther. We thank you that that you even use some of the bad people, too, to fulfill your will. And help us, Lord, to again look back on our lives and see the coincidences. We might have called them, I don't know, we might have said it was destiny, or it was serendipitous, or oh, it was just luck or fate, or you know, any of those fancy little words, Lord. We know that it's just you working things out. Even us sitting here today, we say that you cause us to move and live and have our being. You appoint the times and places of where we're supposed to be. And we may not understand it. We may not know why we're sitting here and why we're studying this. And we may not understand why we're in the job we're at, or why we're married to the person that we're married to, or why we have the job that we have, or why we're in the financial position that we're at. And in all things, Lord, let us continue to look to you to answer those questions and to help us and to encourage us that we can keep going and that you can do something very powerful. Yeah, maybe we won't save, you know, millions of people from death and destruction, but maybe we save one. Maybe there's one person that you've put in our lives that has that irrevocable curse and needs that word of mercy. It's one person that needs a reversal of fortune, that they might have been doomed to destruction, and we have the opportunity to give them life everlasting because of Jesus and everything that he accomplished for us. So, Lord, now, be with us as we come to celebrate your death and resurrection in this time of communion. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.